So I started the week with a pretty high level of optimism on this topic, thinking that we'd be hearing about all the great progress being made. And I have to admit, as a few of the talks went by, I started to grow a bit pessimistic and maybe a little depressed. Hearing about how hard radiative transfer is and feedback is impossible, and you could have a Google flop processor and still not make any progress. And then last night, I reached a pretty high state of optimism once again. Because if the Red Sox can win the World Series, having grown up less than 100 miles away from Boston, anything is possible. It's fair to say. Now, at some level, I'm still a bit concerned that it could take 86 years or so for us to tackle these problems. But I'm kind of young and got some time to wait, at least.
Yeah, it has to be reproducible in style.
It's not going to work. Anyways, I got a bit distracted here. But then I remembered I had a talk to give, and I guess got back to that. So today I'm going to describe a few of the observational efforts that I'm making to attack this IGM galaxy interface problem. From the standpoint of quasar absorption lines, if we're interested in probing the IGM galactic interface, then we're probably talking about sight lines that go not through the galaxy, which will give us a damp Lyman alpha system. We'll hear a bit about those later. And not sight lines that go way out here in the IGM, but again, the in between, the interface, right? And we should be able to probe what the gas conditions are and the velocity fields are in this interface through quasar absorption line systems. And we should be able to probe the interfaces of these bubbles with the IGM, again, through absorption line studies. And so let's try. I'm going to try and attack three different projects. They're sort of related, ranging from what I call high redshift, I suppose, down to kind of local universe. As far as the collaborators go, there are two of them in the room. I wanted to mention Gabe Proctor and Kathy Cooksey, both students at UC Santa Cruz, and by all means, feel free to bug them at your leisure. So let me begin with the Lyman limit systems. These are the most easily recognizable of the quasar absorption line systems because you see flux, you see flux, you see flux, you see no flux. There's a Lyman limit system. Right? You don't need high resolution or even low resolution spectroscopy. You can almost do it with imaging. By definition, they have an optical depth greater than unity at the optical. They have optical depth greater than unity at the Lyman limit, which corresponds to an H1 of greater than 10 to the 17. And I'm sure I could teach even the organizers of this conference to do an observational survey for these systems. So they're pretty well surveyed, but it turns out that they're very poorly studied. All right? It's kind of a contradiction, but the situation. So the thing we do know, as I said, is they're well surveyed. We do know how many there are per unit redshift. This is a set of observations here on the y-axis. And then the one thing we do know, even from the one thing we do know observationally, we find out that we don't know much of anything about these systems. For when you look at numerical simulations, this is from Gardner and collaborators, the prediction for the incidence as a function of redshift is down here, roughly order of magnitude below the observed incidence. And so it's fair to say from the numerical simulations, there just are far too few Lyman limit systems found. And these authors suggested perhaps they're in unresolved galaxies, and I think they may even well be in somehow in large-scale structures that were not resolved in the simulations. From a simulatic approach, Abel Moe suggested that a large fraction of these absorption systems could be in mini-halos, again, very low-mass galaxies. But I think this is a pretty difficult solution to hold. I don't think the solution is going to hold up. As Ari Mahler and I have shown, it's difficult to place the gas in these mini-halos and not have it be photoionized to a point that you really don't get the right number of Lyman limit systems. So we know we have a pretty good handle of how many there are pre-redshift, and we really don't know really what is the origin of these absorbers. In the old picture, the old days, we would say perhaps that Lyman limit systems are sight lines going through the outskirts of galaxies. I'm not sure we can do it that way. I really don't know. It is certainly the case, if you take a numerical simulation and run sight lines close to a galaxy, you are going to get that optical depth. You're going to get the H1 greater than 10 to the 17. But again, it doesn't seem that there's enough cross-section in just those events alone. It may well be that we're going to have a lot more cross-section coming from filamentary gas or clumps of gas towards the outer parts of Halo. What I do know, what I do feel confident in, is that the Langlands systems do represent the interface between galaxies and the IGM out here somewhere. We're definitely probing that space in between. So we can learn about this galaxy IGM interface through observations of Langlands systems. And this is more of an advertisement than a set of observational results. The work is ongoing. So let me say a few of the things that I think we're going to be attacking with our studies. First, the intensity and shapes of the UV background. We can probe that by both the frequency distribution of H1 as well as metal line ratios that we observe. We should be able to, attacking the distribution of gas in the halos and filaments. This certainly comes back to radiative transfer and how one models that. From the metal lines, we probe the kinematics of this gas, whether we're talking about the dynamics of outflows or inflows. We'll have information on that. And I think the Langlands systems are going to play an important role in our understanding of chemical enrichment and possibly the enrichment of the IGM. So a word or two on the frequency distribution of Langlands systems, F of N, as we call it. It's been well measured by David Teutler for the Langlands alpha forest as a power law of N to the minus 1.5 or so. Our recent measurements of the damp system show we have roughly power law N to minus 2 at the high end. And in between, we have roughly no idea of what the frequency distribution is of the H1 comb density. And so at the moment, theory leads observations, which is always an unsettling position to be in. We, again, at the high end, have clean measurements from the damp Lyman alpha systems at the low end, the Lyman forest. And right now, really have no clue what's going on in the interim. And it's an important spot, I believe, because you're transitioning from gas, which is highly neutral, in the damp Lyman alpha systems, to gas, which is highly ionized. And so, as this theoretical model is suggesting, there's quite likely to be a feature in the frequency distribution that one would probe with the Lyman limit systems, and that would give you a sense or place constraints on aspects of radiative transfer and the distribution of gas in the outskirts of galaxies or halos of galaxies.
What do the designated curves with different masses mean in this sense?
I believe the main thing that's changing as you vary the mass is the central density of the gas. I think they've assumed an isothermal profile in every case, but so the. No, these are halos. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So another point I wish to emphasize is that the Langlands systems may be a major metal reservoir. Again, this summarizes the state of affairs on our knowledge of the metal abundances of the Langlands systems. Really, I don't have a good handle on this at all at the moment. From the damp systems, the metal density, omega metal density in damps, that's what this is supposed to mean, is roughly 2 times 10 to the minus 6. We get that by the mass density in gas that we observe and the metallicity we observe in these systems. I think it's a fair statement to say that the mass density in gas in Langlands limit systems is on the order of the mass density in gas of the damp systems. I don't think that would be a shock. So if we take the ratio of the two quantities, then the mass density in metals in Langlands limit systems is just going to be roughly, or at least, a ratio of the metallicity of the two classes as absorbers. In order to probe what the metal abundances are of these systems, we go to the metal lines, and they're far more complicated. It's a far more complicated situation than the damp systems, in that the Langlands systems are partially ionized or highly ionized in some cases, and we see multiple ionization states. We see low ions like iron 2 and oxygen 1. We see intermediate ions like iron 3. We'll observe higher ions like carbon 4 and silicon 4. And in order to get any handle on the abundances, ionization corrections are very important. And at this point, I wouldn't trust anything to an uncertainty of 100%. And this is not the precision we can achieve with damp systems. Yes, I suppose it does. No, not really. But you know, a factor of 2 uncertainty always in the modeling of these numbers. For this system, results on this one Lyman limit system I'm showing here, we inferred an ionization fraction greater than 95%. Which means a total hydrogen column density of 20.7. That's again in the damped Lyman alpha regime. This is a lot of gas with these systems, given the fact that they're highly ionized. And this one has really quite a high metallicity, it's the third solar or so. And in some special cases, particularly those where we observe the fine structure lines, we'll be able to set constraints on the density of the absorber and in turn estimate the intensity of the radiation field. Here it's quite high compared to what we believe the extragalactic background is, and I expect that there's a local contribution to the radiation field. Here's a more extreme example, if you will, with somewhat poorer data. But we've discovered what I call a metal strong laminar system here. The metallicity is, an uncorrected metallicity of 4 times solar. I'm sure when I correct for ionization, it'll come down a bit, maybe only solar metallicity. But the raw column densities alone of silicon and zinc in this absorber are greater than 95% of those that we see in the damped systems. So there's a lot of metals in some of these laminar systems. Of course, I've showed you the rare, the somewhat exceptional cases. This is the current state of affairs of a sample drawn partly from the literature, partly from my own observations. All I want to give you the impression is that there are certainly systems which have solar or nearly solar abundances, as well as absorbers, laminar systems, which have very low metallicity. So the scatter exceeds what we even see in the damped laminar systems. But it's the mean in the end that matters. If you have a fair number of absorbers at solar metallicity, that mean is going to be well in excess of what we see in the damped systems. And at this point, it's just a guess, but I have a feeling that the laminar systems will be a dominant reservoir of the detectable metals at high redshift. So that's the end of this advertisement in the first part of the talk. We have an ongoing Lyman limit survey. The reason why so little information has been put out there so far on the Lyman limit systems is it's a tough observational challenge. You need high resolution, and you need moderate to high solenoids all the way down into the blue wavelengths, 3,400 angstroms or so. Recently, we've had a CC upgrade at Keck, which allows us to do this far more efficiently, and I'm pursuing a program to do about 40 or 50 Lyman systems there. My collaborators at MIT in Michigan are making use of the recently upgraded Mike spectrograph and Magellan telescope, and we're pursuing similar science. At the moment, we're probably up to about 30 systems, and by the end of next year, I'd say we have 50 or even 70 systems. So, part two of the talk, coming down in redshift. Let's now focus on magnesium-2 systems, strong magnesium-2 systems. Probably not talking about a different class of objects. The majority of these magnesium-2 systems, strong magnesium-2 systems, are probably Lyman limit systems, almost certainly. But we identified them at lower redshift simply by the magnesium-2 lines because the Lyman alpha and Lyman limit lie at ultraviolet frequencies, which we can access from the ground. So here's an example of this very strong magnesium-2 system. It's a doublet. You often see, and pretty much always will see, iron lines as well associated with these absorbers. And what got us interested from the observational side were two theoretical descriptions of these absorbers, these strong magnesium-2 systems. Bond and collaborators have suggested that the kinematics that you see here, the very wide profiles, strong absorption, are the result of superwinds or super bubbles flowing out of galaxies into the intergalactic medium. And so we thought that'd be nice to, we'd like to probe that aspect of this. And another model, description put forth by Mo and Merelda Scudé is that these are clouds falling within dark matter halos. Within massive dark matter halos, and you should make that point. And they were really motivated by work done by several people in this room that show that these magnesium-2 systems are frequently associated with bright, luminous galaxies at redshifts of about 1. All right. So two somewhat competing models for these absorbers. Our work, we've done a few things. This is really Gabe Proctor's work. He's done by far the lion's share of the effort. One of the major aspects was a search of the Sloan Digital Sky Survey quasar spectra for these absorbers. There's over 10,000 quasars in the DR2 alone, and probing these types of redshifts. We came up with some automated algorithm to find the absorbers, and then Gabe has painstakingly verified each one by eye. And here's kind of the nutshell summary of that effort. The frequency distribution DNDZ as a function of redshift here on the x-axis, and we've broken up into two samples, a 1 angstrom roughly sample and a greater than 1.8 angstrom sample of magnesium 2 systems. And the standard thing to do is to try and fit the DNDZ evolution with a power law 1 plus C to the gamma. And we've confirmed previous suggestions or claims that there is a steepening in that power law as a function of equivalent width. And so we go from a gamma about 0.9 at 1 equivalent width and to almost 2 for systems with equivalent width greater than 1.8 angstroms. And that's clearly, actually, now with the level of statistics that we're getting now, I don't think a power law fit is really a great description of the data anymore. But you still, there's no question that this issue of steepening takes place. You can see here, by redshift 1.5, we have just as many large equivalent width systems as we do 1 angstrom systems. It's definitely a steepening with equivalent width. One of the things we find compelling, although not perhaps convincing yet, is the suggestion of a turnover in the absorption systems of the very strongest systems around redshift 1.5, and then recovery, clearly, back up to the board, that these are uncorrelated data points. So while we have some concerns about this one, it's uncorrelated with the others, and it really does look like there may be a turnover for a little while at those redshifts. Why is that important? Well, at some level, the results here are a problem for both scenarios. In the massive halo scenario, the notion of clouds falling onto in the halo of a massive galaxy, cooling and falling onto a massive galaxy, if these are tied to massive galaxies, well, at some point you can run out of massive galaxies as you look back in time, right, in hierarchical cosmology. And the actual prediction from Moe and Morales could, it would occur around redshifts 1.5, and so we were quite intrigued by this turnover, but then of course it does recover. So that cannot be the full story of what's going on in these absorbers. There's also troubles with the wind model in that if you're going to tie these strong absorption systems to outflows, to processes related to merging, then you would expect, at least naively, that the power law should go like 1 plus e to the cube power. And we're clearly not seeing that. And so, not surprisingly, I think it's a more realistic situation is that both processes are contributing. And we've considered a very toy model where the majority of these absorbers are due to clouds within more massive halos. And as those turn away, coincidentally, if you will, it's merger processes which take place and are driving the absorption systems at the highest redshifts. We've looked deeper into this with higher resolution spectroscopy, much smaller sample, much, much smaller sample. Here now I'm plotting velocity widths of these systems, kilometers per second. Just a histogram, sample of 22 with ESI and high-res data. And you can see, somewhat to my surprise, that there are very few with large velocity widths. Right? And at some level, this is contrary to what is observed locally, as I believe Crystal will show tomorrow. The wind speeds that she's observing are more in this range of 300 to 400 kilometers per second. And if you recall the discussion from Steidel's talk yesterday, for the winds in Lyman break galaxies, again, we expect wind speeds of many hundreds of kilometers per second, and at the moment, at least, small sample. These are rare. That type of situation is really quite a rare event. And whether or not that means that, if there are winds blowing out of the Lyman break galaxies, perhaps the cross section is smaller than one might expect, or it's also a possibility that we're not probing this highly ionized gas using the magnesium 2 line. Although to address that, we do have a few systems where we can see both magnesium 2 absorption and have coverage of these higher ionization species, carbon 4, silicon 4. And in the very this is now a very small subset of the sample, we do not see any particular, at least gross differences between which is very low ionization ionized gas and these higher ionization species. It looks like they're probing the same velocity fields. And so whatever it is that's driving if you want to have a wind driving the magnesium 2 systems, then it appears to be driving the carbon 4 gas in very much the same fashion. Good. All right, so let me spend the last 10 minutes discussing some of the work I've been doing in the very low redshift, what I call low redshift universe, redshift less than a half or so. To go into that regime, one does have to go to space and use ultraviolet spectrometers on ultraviolet observatories. And I'll be showing you results from the HST and FUSE. results that came from HST are no longer available thanks to the death of Stis, unfortunately. For those of you not familiar with the lower redshift universe, it's a completely different game for as far as quasar absorption lines go. There is really no Lyman alpha forest to speak of, and that's both a boon and a bane. It's nice in that this which is often a contamination, is no longer present, but then getting statistics is a much greater challenge, as we have very much fewer systems to look at. So the results I'll show you are from just one sight line. At low redshift, we don't have that many to work with. This is a particularly good sight line. It's quasar towards PKS. It is the quasar PKS045, which is at a pretty high redshift for this game, 0.57. And we've got very nice data from both the FUSE observatory. I don't know, maybe some of you are not familiar with FUSE. FUSE is a spectrometer that goes down to roughly the Lyman limit, 900 angstroms in the rest frame, resolution about 20,000. It's not very high resolution data, but pretty high resolution data. And then there's high quality STIS observations from about 1,100 angstroms to 1,700 angstroms at a higher resolution. And what I'm focusing on here will be the metal line systems, once again. And it is quite a different game. It was a bit of an adjustment from my own perspective, looking at this type of data and the different types of species we can observe with these observatories. So this is one metal line system along the sight line. Shows strong oxygen 6 absorption, strong carbon 3 absorption, pretty weak actually H1 absorption. And because of the fact that the forest, there isn't really no line of forest, we're able to go after ions like oxygen NC, transitions I had never even heard of before, oxygen 4, oxygen 5, constraints in oxygen 3, oxygen 2 is probably somewhere around here, constraints on neon 8, constraints even on magnesium 10. Okay, and so we can really go to a whole suite of transitions that are just not feasible right now at high redshift. And play the same games, albeit, I suppose, with different transitions than I'm used to. And that is ionization modeling. And I take the simplest approach first, assume equilibrium, assume single phase for the modeling. And it largely, therefore, comes down to whether or not the gas is photoionized versus whether it's collision ionized. And as necessary, we've considered multiphase or non-equilibrium conditions. And again, as I cautioned before, nothing that we're doing here is better to a factor of 2. The modeling is just too difficult and too simplified, really. As far as the details of the ionization modeling, I probably shouldn't go into it in too much detail. It's not that important. But as for collision ionization, we have just a single parameter. If we assume equilibrium, and if that's the temperature of the gas, and if the gas is primarily photoionized, again, we have a single parameter, and that's the ionization parameter, which is the ratio of the number of ionizing photons to the number of hydrogen atoms. And it comes down to comparing ionic ratios against predictions for photonization or predictions for collision ionization. And we've been able to, in most cases, argue that one or the other process dominates and place constraints on the temperature or the ionization parameter. This is just a quick summary, a tabular summary of the systems along this one sight line. There are 7 systems which show significant metal detection. We also looked at an additional 2, I guess, which I highlight here, that do not show any metals and have some pretty tight constraints on the upper limits of their metallicities. And again, we've inferred ionization parameters or temperatures depending on whether the gas is collision ionized or photoionized. And to calibrate yourself, I'm now not talking about Lyman limit systems, but absorbers with 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15, 10 to the 16, canonical, or maybe a little bit high for the Lyman alpha force at high redshift. But at low redshift, we're talking about overdensities, which are almost at the levels, or even at the levels of Lyman limit systems at high redshift. So at some level, again, somewhat similar systems, even though the H1s are different. I do have results on the WIM. We're going to hear a few talks about that tomorrow. Perhaps I'll skip over most of this, other than to say that we're able to perform a neon 8 survey along the sight line, which is an excellent probe of gas at temperatures greater than 10 to the 6 Kelvin. Oxygen 6 tends to probe a little bit lower temperature, a little bit lower than the canonical WIM, whereas neon 8 really does probe what at least the simulations are saying is the dominant temperature, or the predominant temperature of this phase of the universe. And at the moment, for this sideline at least, we found no absorbers with neon 8. More relevant to this conference, I would think, is, say, the enrichment of this gas. And I'm here restricting the analysis to just those absorbers above 10 to the 14. Half show metals, half don't. Although of those that don't, part of it may be, part of it is the fact that the key transitions lie either in a bad region of the spectra or blended with another coincident transition. So I think even some of the misses are metal enriched, but I can't prove it. Key result, maybe to take away with, is that the median of this small sample is in excess of minus 1.5, 1/30th of solar. And there's a large scatter, part of which I will freely admit is due to the modeling uncertainty, but not all of which. I'm sure this, well, I'm quite confident that this absorption system has a metallicity less than 100 solar at, again, low redshift, and I'm quite confident that these systems here are close to solar metallicity. So a factor of 100 spread at least, even amongst this small sample. I plotted metallicity here against the H1 comb density, not to show that there was a correlation. In fact, I didn't really find, haven't found any correlation with any physical property as far as the metallicity goes. So as I'm emphasizing here, I believe that the IGM is significantly higher metallicity at low redshift than high redshift. This is to illustrate that point a little more clearly. Now I'm plotting against redshift on the x-axis, metallicity again. And here is a sample of 12 or so absorbers from this one sightline. This data point comes from a nice survey by Tom Barlow and David Teitler on carbon-4 in the low redshift universe. Lower resolution data, but more absorbers. So still a nice sample. Here are the predictions, the estimates, the measurements, if you will, of carbon-4 and oxygen-6 metallicity, oxygen and carbon metallicity from Anthony and Yope, which we'll hear, I suspect, a bit more about today. And here, again, we believe the median metallicity is somewhere above 10 to the minus 1.5. So plenty of time to play with, 10 billion years, if you will. We do believe we're seeing an evolution in the metallicity of the IGM in these absorbers. Heading towards the finish here, we found an interesting correlation, perhaps not an unexpected one, between the H1 comb density, plotted on the x-axis, and this ionization parameter. So now I've just taken the subset of systems that I'm really quite confident are photoionized, that collision ionization is not playing a big role, and plotted those up. And we have a three-sigma correlation. If I just take our data, here I've plotted some of the data points from the literature file, seem to follow a similar relationship as our own data. What the green line is quite compelling. It's a prediction, if you will, from theory. All I've taken is the overdense relationship with H1 comb density that Ramil and collaborators have shown from numerical simulations. All right. If I assume the ionization intensity is constant, which is not too bad an assumption, then the ionization parameter just goes like 1 over the density, or the NH1 to the minus 0.7 power. So that's the slope of this green line. All right, that's U to the, goes like NH1 to the minus 0.7 power. And the normalization I set by, again, taking the results from Jave, and actually in this case, Ramil and Todd Tripp's work on the Lyman alpha forest at low redshift. And they estimated a intensity of the extragalactic UV background radiation field, which is nicely in line with what Jennifer has said for the, I guess, from the Rexymbia effect. And that sets the normalization. So the green line is purely from their study of the Lyman alpha forest, not metal line systems, just the Lyman alpha forest. Of course, there's direct overlap between the metal line systems and Lyman alpha forest. But I was really quite surprised, or really stunned, to see that it's in actually quite good agreement with what we derive independently from the metal line systems.
Do you mean, since you showed density on the first bullet under theory,
yeah,
the negative power of NH1 to 0.7?
Oop. That should be positive power. Yeah, sorry. Yeah. Sorry about that. Things then got a little upsetting when I did the next obvious thing, and that was to convert. I have H1 comb densities. I know the ionization parameter. I can convert the H1 into a total H. It's a straightforward process. And in doing so, with one exception, you see that these absorbers have roughly all the same total hydrogen column density, within a factor of 2 or so. And I did the same thing with the theoretical line, if you want to call it that, the green line. And the prediction is that, in this simple-minded manner, that roughly 4 orders of magnitude in H1 should map into almost just a factor, just less than even a factor of 2 variation in total H, which is to say that there is a characteristic hydrogen column density of the Lyman alpha forest. Kind of a radical statement. At some level, I'm saying every Lyman alpha forest cloud has the same, or within a factor of 2, the same total hydrogen column density. I don't understand it, fair enough to say. It is something that roughly drops out of Yope's calculations of the Lyman, or treatment of the Lyman alpha forest in terms of a gene's length. It's not clear if the numerical simulations would support this. Ramil and I have looked at this at least in a very quick fashion and could not reproduce it. And even more puzzling, it holds it all redshift. All this statement relies upon is that relationship that I got wrong, that, that shouldn't happen, sorry, that the number density goes like, that the number density goes like NH1 to the 0.7 power. If it was 0.6 power, the relationship's not, the constancy is not, not quite as clear. If it's 0.8 power, it's not as there. It's 0.7 that actually seems to, is really just about the only thing that gives you this type of a relationship. So I don't really fully understand this. I'm not even sure it's got a physical basis, but at the moment it's there, both in the observations and sort of in the theory. And so let me summarize. Let's get the end here. The Lyman limit systems, I believe, I hope, are going to give us real powerful observational constraints on the IGM galactic interface, both on the on issues related to the ionization background and the shape of the background, given the large range of ionization states we observe. I believe they're going to play a major role in the issues of metal enrichment, and I'm sure we can probe kinematics of outflow and inflow of those absorbers. Roughly all the same goes for the strong magnesium 2 systems. The problem here is that we don't have access to the full range of transitions because you require a UV telescope. Nevertheless, what we feel we've understood thus far is that the incidence of these absorbers suggest a mix of L-star galaxies and superwinds. At the moment, at least, the kinematics suggest that large, really large velocity winds are quite rare. And finally, for the lower redshift studies of the IGM, this is just working well. This work I was very excited about until a month ago when Stis died, as we were about to. We had been approved to have an additional 5 sight lines and actually get some statistics. That is no longer the case. Nevertheless, I'm compelled to say that the metallicities are certainly higher than the higher redshift IGM. Probably no big shocker there. We do see a correlation between ionization parameter H1, which is sort of predicted by the simulations, I'd say. And I don't really understand this constancy of NH, or even if it'll ever have a physical basis. Thanks.
Question? Dave?
Jason, when you showed the magnesium 2s as a function of redshift taken from Sloan, mm-hmm. It was quite a bumpy data set, right, as you pointed out. Your discussion of that implied you thought that the bumps were real, and I have a lot of trouble with that in an inhomogeneous universe, to have something that's presumably a mixed sample of all sorts of things changing very suddenly in Z just seems incredible. And it looks to me that the bumpiness is what inhomogeneous surveys used to look like from 20 years ago, when people went through the literature and they plotted up. That's the sort of thing they used to get. So I wondered if you think that's, you really do think that bumpiness is real.
As far as the turnover goes, that, I think, was, if it was just the turnover that we were seeing, I wouldn't have too much difficulty with that. And the fact that if you tie these systems to the gas and the clouds, if you will, and the outskirts of massive halos, you are going to expect a pretty sharp turnover at a given redshift. And so just a turnover actually is a pretty natural prediction, at least of that one model. I am surprised by the bumps and wiggles at some level.
Are they significant?
Not too many of them were significant. The turnover, I think, is significant. Even that I'm not going to bet my life on. Okay. But at the lower redshift end, no, they weren't significant. It is true, however, that the formal chi-squared of a 1 plus z, the gamma power law type fit, is not a good description of the data. And that, I don't think, is going to change. I think it just is not a 1 plus z to the gamma power. But I don't think it had to be that type of a relationship.
Jason, you made a passing remark about the commonality of the kinematics as a function of ionization for the various ions. I think it was for the redshift 1 magnesium 2 systems, arguing against a wind origin. And I think it's dangerous to use that argument, because if you actually look at the absorption line systems that you see right down the barrel of every galaxy one has looked at high redshift, the ions share the same velocities. If you look at CB58, for example, mm-hmm. The profiles look exactly the same, even though they can't possibly be arising in the same in gas with the same physical properties. So you see an envelope of in velocity space that's shared by everything, even when you know the stuff is wind material.
Yeah. So you're saying even the carbon 4 in detail is tracing the low ions. I guess that's fine and surprising. I could see how a wind would sweep up a shell, and you could imagine, I would imagine, that the low ion species would have very similar kinematics. But I would not expect the carbon 4 gas to be predominantly within that shell. I guess that intuitively, that's a surprise that I would
have. As far as we can tell, it is.
Well, with CB58, they do have pretty, you can answer that too, but they have pretty high resolution with CB58. If that were to hold up generically, I would continue to be surprised, and I agree then it would not be, the kinematic argument would not be a strong argument against the wind.
Yeah. Jason, can you show this plot on NH versus NH1?
Yeah. I don't know how to go backwards for some reason. Oh, there we go. Ooh, that's forward.
Oh, this one.
All right. There you go.
So this NH is actually quite high. Oh.
It's coming, yeah.
It's a very naive question. It's 10 to the 18, 10 to the 18.5. Does it mean that those things are ionized from inside? Because they will be self-shielded.
These are optically thin systems. No, they're not self-shielding by any means.
They I mean,
they're large.
They're
large and low density.
NH1 is less than 10.
This is H1 here, down here. Yeah, they're optically thin.
No, I mean, if they were not ionized from inside, they would be totally neutral. They would be self-shielded.
If you have low enough density, which is the case here, or have to be the case here, they will not be self-shielded. This is 10 to minus 5, or
yeah,
10 to minus 6.
I don't think this is a surprise. I think all simulation supported on my analytic model, as you say as well. And this is, I think, one of the reasons why a power law fit to the H1 column density is a reasonable fit over 10 orders of magnitude, because it only corresponds to 2 or 3 orders of magnitude in total hydrogen. And the reason is that if you go to lower densities, the genes length becomes longer, and the total hydrogen column doesn't change much. But because the density is lower, it's much more highly ionized, the neutral fraction is much smaller. And therefore, you get a very big difference in the neutral hydrogen column density, but only a very small difference in the total hydrogen column density.
Just a quick response to Chuck's comment. There's a handful of galaxies that we've looked at with fuse, strong starbursts with high velocity flows that look very similar to Lyman-Break galaxies. And you see even oxygen 6 has pretty much the same profile shape as the neutral gas. So I think it may be hard to understand physically, but empirically it seems to be true. Okay. The question I had was the evolution in metallicity. The way you've plotted this, I guess you've had to measure metallicity for individual systems. But I'm wondering if it might be more robust in a way to look at omega oxygen 6 at low redshift and high redshift just from DNDZ. And so have you done that, and does that support a buildup in omega oxygen 6 from redshifts 3 or 4 to 0?
I see. So I have not done that. The sample I had was only, I guess I could do it with the 6 oxygen 6 systems we observed, but I wouldn't trust that either. Nor has anyone really tried to do that, as far as I know.
Yeah, but if you compare the result, numerically they are the same. The problem is, are they to the same depths at high and low redshift in terms of O6 column density? But the result right now give the same DN of a DZ and the same omega. But I think it's fortuitous. I mean, it's just... Mm-hmm.
So I had a question actually about the Lyman limit systems metallicities. Is there a difference between, have you done the separate metallicities for the low ions and the high ions? Can you do that?
Well, for the one system I was showing, all the ions are consistent with being from one ionization state. And so in doing the analysis, I am forcing you to get the same metallicity from all the ions. Right? So in that case, it's consistent with one ionization, one phase of ionization, one phase of phononization, and there's no difference in the metallicity you would get from any of the ions. Yeah.
I just have two comments. One is about that figure. As you know, I mean, to derive your green line, you took the fit from the simulation, and then you derive the green line and says you get this flat distribution. But as you also know, the simulation doesn't give a flat distribution like that. And the simulation is self-consistent within itself. So, I mean, there's obviously some step in the approximations of the different fits that are just not taking into account the scatter or something that's not giving you the same thing. So that's a brief comment on that. I want to make a brief comment about your metal evolution. I mean, you're comparing it to high redshift and low redshift at the same hydrogen column, but as you, roughly the same H1 column. But
No, I was comparing the same overdensity.
I didn't really say that, but I
Well,
you have columns you were just plotting. I mean, they're right there. They're 10 to the 14, 10 to the 15. And when I
made the plot of the metallicity in this plot, I'm going from plots for some reason, in this plot of the global metallicity as a function of redshift, I am plotting here the metallicity which corresponds to the overdensity suggested by these absorbers. Okay, so I've taken Yope's prescription of metallicity as a function of overdensity. These have overdensities about 20. I put in 20.
All right.
Okay, we'll move on. So I'm comparing same overdensity. Back to it.
You usually talk about the chemical abundances of these systems and how that's indicative of different star formation patterns. You haven't done it this time.
Well, I think you probably know why, and it was that factor of two uncertainty, right? And if I'm going to say anything reasonable or sensible about whether you have type 2 supernova or type 1, I got to get much better than a factor of two uncertainty, and I don't feel comfortable doing that. Yeah, not yet. Maybe someday.
Yeah, a short question. At lower redshift, for those which have both UV and optical data, there is a strong correspondence between Lyman limit system and strong magnesium 2 system.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, could you say something that you are comparing magnesium 2 and Lyman limit system at different redshift? And therefore, could you link some way the two or not?
Not yet.
I think the
clear overlap in observables would be, say, the iron 2 column density distribution. You can measure that from both samples. I haven't tried that yet, but that would be the first thing I would attempt. You could also look at velocity, kinematic structure. You should be able to look at the velocity widths of the metal ion systems from both redshift 1 and redshift 2 systems, and that's another thing that I definitely will look into, but we don't have. Particularly at the high redshift, we don't have the sample yet to do that. Yeah.
Okay. No more questions? Okay, we thank Chuck again.